Welcome to Bombshell. I'm Erin Simpson.
And I'm Radha Iyengar.
And Lauren is en route back from a lovely lake vacation, so you all get just the two of us today, which means we are going to geek out.
Oh my God. Should we just like talk about statistics the whole time?
I was really trying to think about like a measurement thing and like, could we just go deep on like COVID measures and specificity and accuracy?
I went really long on COVID testing accuracy when we got back from our road trip. So if anyone has follow-up questions on sensitivity, specificity, and positivity rates, like, I have discussion points.
I'll be honest, I love statistics and I've always hated remembering like what the difference is between all of those things. So
I just don't understand why every profession has a different combination of like false positive, true positive, false negative, true negative, like in different ratios. I'm like, can we just all agree on one set? I don't care what they are.
It's ridiculous. More importantly, Radha, what are you drinking?
I am drinking a lovely actual champagne from the Champagne region in France that I ordered because yesterday I attended a beautiful virtual wedding for a colleague of mine, and it was delightful. They had their wedding in their backyard in Brooklyn. They live streamed in various groups of people. The grooms came around to the different watching rooms. They had a band live stream in. So if you need virtual wedding tips, you should talk to these guys because it was great.
Fantastic. Well, champagne sounds delightful. I am drinking gin and LaCroix, which is a little bit less classy.
So, you know,
it's so good.
It is good. I just tried a Wegmans ginger flavored, the Wegmans version of LaCroix mixed with gin is delicious.
I believe it. Yes. So I'm actually drinking Tomstown gin, which is a Kansas City area distillery that I got while I was home this summer. So that's great. And unsurprising to anyone, that bottle's almost gone. So we'll need to go to the ABC here before too long. So we're going to do a fairly traditional lineup while going fairly deep on the trade segment. So we're going to start off, though, with keeping up foreign relations and let's talk about this blast in Beirut, which was just sort of mesmerizing over social media on the day that it actually happened as folks watched this enormous smoke plume and then damage reported for miles and miles and miles. What do we know about this?
They felt the blast in Cyprus.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is not close by.
Yeah. So I believe what we know is that the explosion was a 2,700 ton ammonium nitrate stockpile that basically exploded after a warehouse fire in the dock kind of spread to this area where the storage was happening, and that storage had been flagged as potentially concerning giant pile of explosive fertilizer several times by the port and dock owners to the government, and was not removed and then exploded.
So I think at this point, there's over 150 people confirmed dead, potentially 300,000 Lebanese residents now homeless because the blast, basically the blast shockwave just leveled and destroyed all of these houses.
Just for context, that is the same explosive material used in Oklahoma City, which was, I think, three orders of magnitude, so 2 tons in Oklahoma City. And we're talking about 2,750 tons. So like just
an enormous like physical blast. And so I guess part of, you know, what's being written about now, first of all, was like, well, how did this, you know, ammonium nitrate come to be just hanging out in the port? And that's kind of its own, like, only in Lebanon sort of story, which was that a ship came through there, a commercial ship came through there in 2013 under a strange flag, didn't have the fine, you know, or the fees, you know, properly or whatever. And so all of the cargo was impounded, and that was this 2,700 tons of ammonium nitrate, and then it was left there. So this extremely explosive fertilizer has been sitting in the port in Lebanon, in Beirut, for over 6 years, with no real regulation, no remediation, no forwarding on to its next, you know, customer or returning to sender or any of these things. And it's a little bit emblematic of some of the challenges the Lebanese government has had in terms of actual governance, actual administration, and you know, properly protecting its citizens. As a result, we've had pretty significant
protests.
Yeah, there was huge protests over this weekend. We're recording on Sunday and Saturday and Saturday night in Beirut. There were marked protests, some of which became fairly violent, a mix of security force violence and protesters. So pretty significant anti-government sentiment and activity occurring in the wake of this blast.
And just like a couple of points of context for that. One, so as a result of the protest last night, at least my reading this morning, again, recording on Sunday, was that the protesters stormed four government ministries, right? Stormed and occupied buildings with them. So these are pretty both widespread and relatively sort of forward-leaning, shall we call them, protests. They're not, you know, just marching down the street. They actually occupy buildings. People are very angry. The second thing to note is, like most of the world, Lebanon is both dealing with a pandemic and an economic recession. That recession is actually, like, not great, but also a continuation of continued economic decline from government corruption and government issues. So there are a number, as Aaron alluded to, of longstanding issues with the Lebanese government that I think have made both their response to the pandemic, their response to this stockpile issue, and sort of public sentiment very negative.
I was thinking, you know, as this, when this happened, you know, several of us and many of our listeners have participated or designed war games over the years, and in Beirut, or humanitarian assistance to Lebanon is a frequent topic of consideration in those war games. And I was thinking, you know, never in my wildest dreams would I have thought to use massive explosion of 2,000 tons of ammonium nitrate as a kickoff to one of these things. But there is a lot of discussion right now around humanitarian assistance. It appears the French are kind of taking the lead on this. Emmanuel Macron was there on the ground this last week after the explosion. I don't know that we've announced any sort of specific American response or even whether military or on the USAID side, but there are some global kind of fundraising and commitment efforts to try to get folks to commit to humanitarian relief. But as Radha notes, this is in the context of, one, a significant refugee challenge because huge numbers of Syrian refugees have taken residence in Lebanon over the last 5 or 6 years. And as well, a very complicated governance arrangement in Lebanon between the various, you know, Lebanese Catholic, Sunni, and Shia, and as a result, Hezbollah parts of the government. So it's an extreme challenge from the governing side. This was the kind of tripartite agreement that led to the end of their civil war 20-some years ago, but makes it challenging to deliver humanitarian assistance. Some of that would almost certainly be distributed by Hezbollah, for example, and that would be an interesting dynamic for many Western governments to navigate. So I guess we'll watch those elements and see how the response goes, but also, you know, if this is, you know, the Lebanese government has been teetering on the brink for 15 years, and it's never quite fallen apart. We'll see if this blast has enough shockwave to change something.
Just to round that out, the New York Times had a good rundown of various international humanitarian organizations that are doing various different kinds of assistance, keeping in mind that there is the housing and homelessness, there is the first line workers who need to both respond and have protective equipment because it is still a pandemic. And then there is the actual hospitals and medical infrastructure, much of which was damaged from the explosion itself, and so a need for that. So we'll include the link to that, which has a vetted set of agencies that folks can donate to if they're interested.
Fantastic. So shifting gears a little bit, we are several months into this pandemic, as we all are very painfully aware. We thought we'd do a little bit of a rundown of kind of a best and worst, partially because the best has some extremely good news right now, which is the fine people of New Zealand.
Yeah, they've had 100 days with no new cases.
Can you imagine? I mean, that
no,
just...
I literally can't. So I will say I'm in New York State, which has really high testing and really low positivity rate, 1%. And the difference between that and California is like really notable. So I think the thing here that is interesting is the thing that seems to have worked for New Zealand is very aggressive border controls, which admittedly is easier when you're an island, though not perfect.
It turns out.
Japan and Australia both have had resurgences that New Zealand hasn't. So like there's balance there, but they had very strict border control and they also had very generous economic compensation responses for the shutdown. So basically when they locked down, they really locked down. Right. And then they basically got the virus down to zero and now they've just opened back up. So their economic decline has also been a little bit shorter and more and less large, so both shorter in duration and less large in terms of loss sense, which does give us some suggestions that maybe very tight lockdown for short periods of time to get things under control and then allowing opening may be more effective than less stringent lockdowns and more gradual openings, which seems to be strategies in other parts of the world that do lockdown.
it's hard to see the New Zealand as a model for the United States, which is just so different both in terms of geography and economy. But maybe the United Kingdom could take a page from the Kiwis. And I actually saw, I have friends who are living in London right now, and they were took the train to Scotland over the weekend and were able to you know, travel. And I was like, well, that's just looks so refreshing and also almost unimaginable to me at the moment. But the UK is kind of in between. They had a stricter lockdown phase than we did, although did not do a great deal of public assistance during that period. And right now, the Boris Johnson government is kind of engaged in a somewhat of a campaign to reopen schools here in the fall and to kind of push the narrative that they are perhaps in a better situation in terms of management than the underlying data would suggest. But they're kind of in a middle ground. I was looking at the Europe numbers writ large. They seem to be where a lot of folks were hoping the United States would be, which would be that after lockdown, you would have some relaxation and then have hot spots where you need to then reimpose more strict quarantining and masking and testing protocols. And so we're seeing some of those spikes, and the countries have some variation in their responses. One of the things I think that a lot of people are looking at least on the European side, is that some schools have opened. And so they're looking to see the kind of medium, you know, short and medium term impacts on, you know, the infection rate, then the positivity rate, and whether testing can be sustained, you know, as elementary and secondary schools return. So,
and the Daily actually has a nice rundown, admittedly now about a week and a half old, of the evidence that's coming in and out of that, and also the different strategies that were tried. So pods, mass separation, et cetera, outdoor. So there are a lot, there's, you know, hopefully, if you're interested in identifying dimensions that work and dimensions that don't, a good amount of variation in Europe on different approaches here. Though, just to be clear, everyone's approach is that if you open schools, you don't like have giant 800 person beach parties inside.
No, well, what we're doing right now is having 800-person beach parties, and we're sort of, you know, on the fence about school. So that's great. So speaking of the United States, there are some other countries that are also on the struggle bus.
Yeah.
And that is to be, that makes light of what's a really terrible situation in both the U.S. and Brazil. Is that right?
Correct. So top three countries in the world right now are 5 million cases in the U.S., 3 million in Brazil, and 2 million in India. So let's kind of run through.
And that's out of roughly 18 or 19 million total. So the United States has a quarter of the global COVID cases. We do not have a quarter of the global population.
Correct. So actually, India at 2 million with, you know, more than a third of the world's population is like not great, but like not as bad as it could be.
Right.
Brazil is not doing great. They're at 3 million infections. They're at over 100,000 deaths. And the thing is, in the US and in Europe, death to infection rates actually have been going down over time. Mm-hmm. We're better at treating COVID when you get it. This is not to minimize the long-term effects of having it, just to say you're less likely to die at this point than you were when we first encountered the disease. Brazil, we're not seeing that, in part because the healthcare infrastructure there is worse, in part because there's a lot more variation in who's getting it and higher comorbidity rates. And frankly, in part because the president and the sort of popular messaging is like, it's the flu, it's not that big a deal, suck it up, which has really impeded the healthcare response, both in the readiness sense and in the people being willing to seek out care. So it's very troubling in Brazil. There's a huge push there, much like in India and much like in the US, to restart the economies, all of which were badly hurt by the lockdown. But that means that all of those places are seeing infection growth. So that doesn't mean just like they have high rates of infection, but those rates are increasing still over time. So we're not on the flat of the curve. We're still in the steep of the curve. And that is the most concerning part of this.
And well, maybe we'll do, Radha, you know, a bit later in the fall, kind of our favorite, like, unexpected economic consequences of, you know, COVID. There were some interesting things about the used car market earlier this year, because companies like Hertz were potentially going out of business, and they were going to dump, you know, their entire fleet of Corollas and Ford Fusions, which we all drive when we have to rent cars, or at least we used to. Another one was weather forecasting, because commercial flights aren't flying. We aren't getting the kind of passive data collection that they are able to collect and transmit, especially on transatlantic and transpacific flights. And so the quality of weather forecasts has diminished as the quantity of data has reduced. Would never have guessed that, right? So there's all kinds of interesting things. And if you think of two large economies, and in particular really large regional economies like Brazil and India. These are going to have much longer term effects than sort of like, oh, well, the BRICS are kind of, you know, half-assing their response to COVID. These economies and political regimes play outsized roles in the region, even if it kind of in the United States, we don't fully appreciate the impact of those countries.
That's right. And I think like in particular, you know, Brazil and the region in Latin America, but India in particular is really playing out on a number of dimensions where we see, you know, COVID impact on the battered economy and frankly, like poor public health infrastructure and a very poor class of workers that need to do in-person work. At the same time, this really increased demand and push for high-tech self-reliance this week in other news, India instituted an import ban where they're going to stop buying a bunch of high-tech military equipment. So high-tech combat equipment like combat helos, sonar, and so on and so forth. And they want to source that and sort of beef up the internal domestic defense industry. Not a terrible idea, especially in light of China. There are some implications for purchases from places like the U.S. and Israel.
Inconsistent with kind of long-standing Indian non-alignment and some other things.
Correct.
Although they have a lot of Soviet equipment from back in the day.
But like, I think this move to sort of self-containment culture is happening at the same time. So we see it in the U.S. We're seeing it a little bit in Europe in response to the U.S. We certainly see it with China. We see it with India. At the same time, we desperately need a global supply chain to function perfectly in order to get a vaccine to market at scale as soon as it's developed, which means manufacturing plant sharing information across IPs, across IP regimes, right, which China and even to some extent much of Asia haven't been super compliant with. It means sharing production and quality standards, which India and Southeast Asia haven't always aligned with the US on in terms of worker standards and healthcare requirements in particular. And it means actually producing it and getting it to scale and delivering it to people, which the U.S. has not been great at and is likely to be worse at given like sort of recent polling on trust in medical industry and trust in vaccines specifically. So there's a really big question here on the impact, the extent to which the global supply chain is going to be sort of in some cases vindicated by COVID or demonstrating how dangerous it is to rely on this type of global production market for like literally life or death production.
So speaking of the global supply chain and the potential decoupling of large economies within that supply chain, are you ready?
Whatever could you be speaking of?
This is one of those things that, like, you can imagine that if you were just slightly older, you know, maybe a lot older than us, because we're hip, we're with it, Radha, right? Like, we definitely have our finger on the pulse of the kids. And
I definitely know about the TikToks.
And their TikToks and their WeChats and their Snap Faces or whatever, right?
Yeah.
It would be difficult to explain to some folks the impact or the potential import of decisions that the president made this week in two executive orders. But we are referring to significant restrictions that the president has placed on two Chinese companies and their affiliates, mostly known in the commercial space as TikTok and WeChat. But of course, these are much broader entities, specifically WeChat. TikTok, for folks who don't know, is like a really cool way that basically kids kind of make music videos and like sing along, and it's got cool like editing functions or whatever. And it's already essentially the US-based subsidiary or like the foreign, you know, facing subsidiary of a Chinese company. So it's a big deal in terms of like it'll impact more like actual humans in some ways if they aren't able to use that app. But WeChat, which is a Chinese social media service, but much more, it's kind of like Twitter, Snapchat, Apple Pay, and Uber all rolled into one in terms of the services that it provides. But it's also the subsidiary company of a company called Tencent, which is huge. Radha, what else should we know about this?
So let me just break it into two parts. So ByteDance, which owns TikTok, as you rightly mentioned, basically TikTok is their entry into the US market. So we do actually care about this, and there are actually pretty legitimate national security reasons to think like, hey, we want to be pretty careful with this because while it is an international subsidiary, it does have access to a lot of data and let's call it ambiguous / porous agreements on how that data protection and data storage works, right? So that piece actually is what it is, but there's a lot of discussion that has been had on sort of how we think about the integration of TikTok into the social media market in the US. WeChat is a more complicated situation because the parent company actually invests in lots of things in the U.S. and in particular things like Tesla, which we think of as core U.S. companies and like not really in the same idea as social media and these kind of.
But also, you know, a significant number of video games. So they have, they actually wholly own Riot Games. They're involved in Activision and Blizzard. My brother was like, oh man, I'm going to have to like review all my, brother who's a trade lawyer is going, he's like, I have to review all my games and see if they're compliant. They also have shares in Spotify. And they, I believe, if I read these articles correctly, were investors in Top Gun 2. So there's a whole bunch of sort of tendrils to that particular investing organization.
And I will say, like, they invest in a lot, but they also do a ton, just to tie this slightly to the pandemic, they do a ton in terms of medical infrastructure, utilities, the general investment. They are really
interesting,
in some senses, part of this global supply chain and part of this sort of, you know, efforts to create interoperable medical systems, areas where we haven't traditionally, maybe incorrectly, been as worried about like sort of having integration with Chinese infrastructure. And this calls a lot of that into question, question mark. Like maybe it does, the executive order is weird because it has this like get out of jail free card where like the, I think Secretary of Commerce, Secretary of Treasury, Secretary of Commerce, right? Can just be like, psych, guys, you're fine.
Well, so I read a really good Lawfare primer on this from Bobby Chesney, and thank God he, you know, reads these things in details and knows these facts so that he can digest it and I don't personally have to. But I'm going to give you two great acronyms, Radha, and we can then, you know, dissect them for our listeners. CFIUS.
My God, I love CFIUS. Let's talk so much about it.
And IEPA, also your favorite.
IEPA.
Yes. Hmm. So
excellent.
About a week ago, Bobby Chesney, who's a professor at the University of Texas, went through and basically said, you know, if there were going to be action against TikTok, there's two legal frameworks by which this could occur. The first is under CFIUS. Radha, tell us briefly what CFIUS is.
I like the inclusion of CFIUS briefly. So CFIUS is basically an interagency committee that reviews investments of foreign investments in U.S. company or operations with the like sort of lens of national security. So the idea is we don't want too much foreign ownership of core elements of national security technology and development. PLDR.
Correct. IEPA is the International Emergency Economic Powers Act. And I hear about that way less than CFIUS. I hear about CFIUS all the time, like in kind of my, you know, world, and partially because of my brother, but partially because of my job and, you know, a few other things. But IEPA, I had not really heard about until this administration decided to start doing strange trade things. And one of the things that the two executive orders signed this week draws on is a previous executive order, which basically bans or elevates concerns around foreign-owned investments or foreign-owned communications and IT infrastructure. Now, to be honest, that sounds pretty valid to me, right? I don't like the idea. You know, this is, goes back to kind of Huawei potentially and other kinds of things about having foreign-owned infrastructure. The question is whether or not these apps and the investment companies in these apps constitute foreign-owned actual infrastructure.
Right. And so just to remind folks, we last heard about IEPA in the context of this 2019 executive order where the president wanted to essentially restrict trade with Mexico on national security grounds related to illegal immigration. So wanted to apply IEPA to allow us to impose tariffs on Mexico without violating existing agreements. So that's just like, is a reminder. And so the context for what this allows the president to do is essentially exercise extraordinary powers in restricting different kinds of trade and engagement by declaring an emergency and sort of exercising these emergency powers. The president, President Trump, had threatened essentially that he was going to do this a while ago in one earlier round of the trade war with China and directed U.S. companies to look at alternatives to Chinese companies, but he didn't actually declare the emergency that you would, he didn't follow the protocols needed to exercise the requirement to do that under IEPA, if that makes sense. He just kind of threatened IEPA.
As you noted, Radha, the executive orders themselves are poorly written, perhaps. They're not, This is part of some ambiguity.
There's
lots of things about this administration that drive the bombshell crew crazy, not the least of which is sort of the inhumane politics and whatnot. But a lot of it is just the sheer incompetence around things that you're trying to get done. So that's sort of irritating just in and on its face. But one of the things that the executive orders does say is that it bans, quote, any transaction with ByteDance and a similar kind of wording for WeChat and Tencent. That's potentially overbroad, right?
After 45 days.
Well, so right, after this review.
Get your house in order, exactly. Basically.
And so if implemented, and the Secretary of Commerce has the ability to then specify exactly which transactions will trigger, so maybe we'll be able to review this, you know, in September or early October at some point. But it's a little, you know, the debater in me is a little bit like void for vagueness, you know, and I'm sure lawyers would consider this, you know, overbroad in some sense. But to step back a little, it's basically a pretty significant escalation in the trade war that we've been talking about, you know, for 3 years now. And in terms of really being, you know, very pointed, this is not about like small ratcheting of tariffs that could then be ratcheted back down. I mean, obviously, this is by executive order, so a potentially new administration could, you know, just void the previous executive order. But it is a really substantial escalation and effort to decouple the kind of really just like U.S. consumer economy from key elements of the Chinese economy. And I have no idea how that plays out long term. Like, I was just sort of thinking, well, what's the Chinese response to this? And I mean, it could be substantial. One of the articles I was reading in prep for today talked about just the specific impact to Apple because of the way Apple has Apple devices. If Apple devices don't have WeChat on them, they're kind of useless to Chinese consumers. And China is like the third largest market for Apple in terms of all of its things. It's a huge source of revenue for Apple. And so, you know, as a core American company, just one example of, you know, potential impact here. So there's,
I think the other just like big piece of this is coupled with the statement is President Trump suggesting that any company who wanted to do a transaction that would get approved would be expected to pay fees to the Treasury Department.
Fees?
Yeah.
Cash maybe? Or like, is this like a suitcase situation?
Just like unmarked small bills? That's not really clear.
Be ashamed if anything happened to you?
Right. So it's a little bit like the combination of the time constraint and this like weird Treasury question mark. Like, it makes it seem like much more of a, like, we want a kickback for a pending Microsoft TikTok deal that pressures TikTok essentially, or ByteDance really, to come to the table and do it rather than. I don't know the way we
just like normal administrative law. Like,
it's really weird because, like, you know, when I was at Department of Energy, for instance, there's a lot of things that go through CFIUS as it relates to energy technology, as it naturally should. And I must say that CFIUS is not like a hot topic among the young kids.
No.
And so it is just a very weird situation to note that, you know, there had been this CFIUS review of ByteDance and Musical.ly, and there was like an expected future ruling, and all of that is just kind of like up in the air / out the window pending this interpretation of this executive order, which I think adds a lot of just uncertainty and complexity to the market.
And I would say also, you know, to kind of wrap this up, you know, this is one part of an ongoing trade discussion and escalation of trade. Trade hostility sounds weird, but, you know, tit for tat ratcheting of trade. But it's also part of a broader discussion of, you know, which we've talked about before, you know, how do you do kind of major power competition with really integrated economies? Mm. And which I think is a really important question. I think it's a really complicated question. I think this is a pretty poor effort at doing it. So, you know, how do you, I don't think that there's a way to forcefully decouple the US and Chinese economies, nor do I think there should be. I think that there's a lot of reasons to want to have, I mean, the U.S. should invest in its own 5G solution so we can sell it to the Five Eyes, you know, countries, for example.
Sure.
The U.S. should invest in greater, you know, testing or some, you know, pieces of the healthcare supply chain so we are maybe less reliant on overseas, you know, suppliers for certain reagents and other kind of, you know, base chemicals, right? Like this, you know, there's sort of there is some core investment in U.S. entities, but that's different to my mind than this sort of punitive action, which uses the national security challenges as an excuse to potentially pursue, you know, other, I don't know, populist or nationalist economic activities.
We're all the economists have been for 3 years in the administration. I'm so glad that we added It's a Gas to our podcast.
That's right.
Three years ago. And yes, if you remember, folks can look back in the archives at when I talked to you about the various different authorities available to do this and how basically they all had national security exemptions in them because we all thought the U.S. would use them in good faith. And so this is just very...
Joke's on us.
Yeah. Continues to undermine, you know, global international economic order. For bygones.
Bygones. Okay. White House mayhem. There's a little or a lot, or it's actually sort of hard to tell. Like, I feel like it's like in like the sixth season of The Office right now, and it's kind of phoning it in until like it does something crazy, like drop 4 executive orders on a Friday night and maybe they're going to defund Medicare. Right. But this is not a podcast for domestic policy. We're not going to talk about the post office. There's lots of things going on and many of them are bad, but we try to focus on things we know about more or less. So we're going to talk about Afghanistan because it's still a thing. And Radha and I used to know about it. So it's sort of a two-parter. Maybe Radha, we can start with the developments in Afghanistan itself.
Yeah, go.
So there was, I don't know if it was technically a loya jirga over the weekend, but there was a large consultative assembly over the last few days in Kabul. Over 3,000 delegates brought together by Afghan President Ashraf Ghani. And they were there essentially to give Ghani political cover to release the last 400 or 500 prisoners that were part of kind of the preconditions for talks between the Afghans and the Taliban themselves. So if folks kind of remember previous discussions of this topic, the United States and the Taliban came to kind of a preliminary deal or a deal to make a deal in February this year that involved some drawdowns and some other kind of confidence building measures. But all of that had occurred between the United States and the Taliban to the exclusion of the Afghan government. And so there were a number of steps then that the Taliban had essentially demanded that the Afghan government make and the U.S. government pressured the Afghan government to make in order for there to be direct talks between the Afghan government and the Taliban, which had not occurred to date and still haven't occurred to date, not direct talks. So with the meeting of this loya jirga and the quote-unquote approval to release the last 400 to 500 prisoners, it should be the case that there would be imminent direct talks between the Taliban and Ghani administration in Afghanistan. That would be the first. That has not occurred in, I don't know when it was last time that there were direct talks, maybe never, but it's been a while. So potentially a good thing. Meanwhile,
I'm not sure this is really a change so much as a statement of a thing, which is
a statement of a thing,
which I think should summarize our Afghanistan policy, just to be clear, which is that Esper in a Fox News interview, which is how we talk about our policies now, we don't go to hearings or do that kind of thing, and noted that the U.S. would be drawing down troops in Afghanistan to under 5,000
in November of this year.
Correct. Which is pretty consistent with sort of ongoing discussions. I think the last number that had been floated was a little over 8,000. Now we're down to 5,000. I think, you know, as we've discussed before, it remains ambiguous at best to me what it is we're doing with 5,000 troops in Afghanistan. Like, if we're going to have 5,000, maybe we have 15. Like, do we have zero?
It's a very interesting kind of salami slicing, but this is one of the conditions that was part of our negotiations with the Taliban, which was an ongoing troop reduction. So we think, although as Radha notes, we aren't in the public entirely sure that there were 11 or 12,000 troops there in Afghanistan, U.S. troops, coalition troops there at the beginning of this year. Now we're down to maybe 8,500, and this would reduce that to effectively half. Just after the election, I mean, there's an interesting question here of a little bit of a U.S. electoral politics. I don't think that there's a huge constituency for Afghan policy, certainly not in Trump's base. But fascinating to remember what the blowback was in the Obama administration around similar discussions, and that we're having, I guess, one takeaway from this. This is like page A17, right? I mean, this is like the end of Charlie Wilson's war when the House...
You know what it is? Did you ever read The Lord of the Rings? You know how it ends and there's a big battle scene and then just like the book goes on for like 500 more pages and you're like, why am I still reading this book? That's what this is.
Yeah. No, it's exactly right. It's the Return of the King, and we're on the third coda, and it's like...
It's like, I don't care about Worm, whatever his name is, and all of his corruption.
The thing is, though, I do care about what happens here. I care that it's done properly, but we're not doing any of the things...
But Aaron, we didn't do any other parts of this properly, so I feel like, why start now?
Fair. Okay. What other White House mayhem do we have?
So, I suggested that we talk about some... combination of things that relates to the fact that I think it's become clear that the president is not getting accurate information and he likes it that way. So let me kind of lay out the situation of things.
You're going to have to be more specific.
gonna see what you think, Aaron. So for folks who didn't listen, I found the Axios interview with Jonathan Swan with the president to be particularly interesting and enlightening on a number of fronts. And in particular, he very earnestly showed a number of graphs as they relate to COVID, showing how well the United States was doing. President Trump was showing this. Now, it turns out what he was showing was graphs in the U.S. of deaths over infections, which, as I alluded to earlier, we're actually doing better on. And we, in fairness, are doing better than many places in the world. We are very good at treating sick people if they're not Black or brown. When they have diseases and come to the hospital. What we are not doing super well on is either infections or total deaths, which we have a lot of and like literally more than anyone else in the world. But the president did not have those numbers, and those were not the numbers he was given. And he sort of, when pressed, seemed very convinced that these were the numbers he should have. This sort of discussion came on the heels or sort of in parallel with the discussion of a CNN White House reporter who has a book coming out talking about how a number of examples of how the military essentially didn't present the president with a full set of military options and didn't really sort of give him all of the information he needed because they were worried about the decisions he was going to make, which is not great for things like civilian control of the military and or like the chain of command. Like it's just like the president is the commander.
But also well foreseen by Bombshell 4 years ago. This was a Goldilocks problem of what if he just picks too hot all the time? Yeah.
Right.
Turns out he does. Yeah.
And, you know, the normal COA approach of too hot, too cold, just right doesn't work if you always pick too hot. And so what if you just present too cold and just right and hope that that works out? Maybe. But, you know, you really are sort of undermining decision making. And so I think there's this. And so there have been a lot of sort of palace intrigue stories about Mark Meadows' approach to the White House, the newest, chief of staff. Current and newest chief of staff.
And certainly John Bolton's book has a number of tawdry or, you know, other sorts of details about just how incompetent this person was that John Bolton defended in the public for years and years.
I just think, you know, there's something really important here to recognize about not just sort of incorrect decision making, but the, you know, people always say you can lie with statistics. And my answer is always like, well, you can also lie with words. And I think this is one of these things, though, right, where like the president is being presented with words and numbers that confirm his beliefs. And so he really believes what he believes. And we get further and further down the rabbit hole. And I think we're kind of starting to understand really how and why that's happening. And I think that is giving us a different picture of the extent to which he's really playing four-dimensional chess or the extent to which his staff is really managing up air quotes effectively and sort of that is not helping the situation.
There was also a line, I think, from Robert O'Brien, who it turns out is the national security advisor for those of you who
Aaron
might have forgotten that.
This, and I was like, he used to be hostages, now he's national security. Where's he again?
He was on Face the Nation this weekend and basically said, you know, I don't get involved in the president's discussions with other foreign leaders. You have one job.
I'm like, isn't that literally your job?
Literally
like
your job.
Your actual job is to advise.
Because we know he's not managing the interagency process because there isn't one, right? So there really is, you know, I mean, we have, you know, actual mugs that say process is my Valentine. And it's very easy to make fun of us OCD Bombshell ladies and our devotion to process, right? But we, I think, have both an empirical but also a moral or kind of ethical commitment to process that drives good policy, that the American public deserves at least a process, ideally a transparent process, and ideally a process that refines and informs policy over time. Now, that latter part doesn't always happen. You know, there's a little bit of sausage making and occasionally a, you know, elephant gets built by committee, right? But the alternative of there being no real process, kind of anarchy, or instead an emperor has no clothes process, right? A place where you're basically trying to kind of manage the whims or the outbursts of a, for the most part, fairly unengaged president is deeply problematic on 17 different levels, only one of which is that you aren't actually generating good foreign or national security policy. I was actually thinking, Radha, you know, on the WeChat, you know, executive orders, like what's the strategy? And that's an easy question to ask in DC, and it's often kind of a throwaway. But I mean, like, no, but literally, what are they trying to achieve? And how do they think that this is a step toward getting that? And by they, I mean Matt Pottinger. You know, I mean a number of folks that we know. But if you're a China hawk and this, you think this is your unique moment, and you've stuck around the administration in the face of all kinds of morally questionable, bordering on indefensible, you know, actions, what is it about? You know, did you, is this what you're hanging your hat on? And what do you think this is getting you? What is it building that you, you know, think is important for the defense of the nation? And I mean, I can often find that, you know, people who want to leave the New START treaty, for example, like I think are wrong, but I understand what they think, right? They think the Russians are a bunch of cheaters and that we're fools for sort of, you know, agreeing to cap our stockpiles, you know, and our, you know, launch vehicles or whatever. I struggle on these other pieces to figure out, you know, what is the underlying approach? I don't even want to call it a strategy, but just
right.
How does A link
what's
to B? What's
the theory of the case? Yeah.
Theory of
I
the
agree.
Case. And I think you're right that it's not four-level chess. It is just sort of like day-to-day these folks are trying to get home to dinner, and this is the best way out is to tell the man, is to give the boss man, a red bar going down and a thumbs up. And, you know, it's like texting your parents emojis because you don't know what else to say. I mean, that's essentially the White House management strategy at the moment. It's extraordinary.
Yeah, I don't really have anything to add to that.
Can we talk about pop culture instead?
Let's do it.
See if we can, you know, just wash away. You watched a sports movie.
I did. So I have two pop culture things to talk about, which will illustrate the range of activities that I currently do. So the first is I watched The Rookie. And my takeaway from it is some people really miss baseball. I'm not one of those people, but I understand that some people exist. And, you know, duly noted, I guess. It is a fine movie if you're going to have such a movie. And, you know, here we are later. Apparently, my husband took that to mean that I should now watch Field of Dreams, which I'm also probably going to have to watch because I have nothing else to do. But
I don't think that Field of Dreams is your jam. I can imagine you enjoying Bull Durham. Bull Durham is an actual interesting
movie. I've seen
movie.
Bull Durham.
Yes, okay.
As a result of this being a thing. And, you know, there's banter.
Yes.
The other thing I would just strongly encourage people to listen to is this new podcast called Nice White Parents, which is from the folks that make Serial. And I don't want to spoil too much about it, but it's basically about a bunch of white families who convince the state through a lot, or the city through New York City, through a lot of writing, to move a school that had planned to be in a minority neighborhood to their area, and then don't end up sending their kids there. And what happens to the school and why these parents did this crazy thing. It's from the 70s, but it sort of like interviews people back in time. And I think it really, for me, not to make everything about race, but to make this clearly about race, podcast about race, to like things that are really useful, which is one, sometimes you can be a real jerk even when you think you're being nice. I think that's really important to recognize. And two, just because you're not using racist words doesn't mean you're not racist. I think the combination of the two and binge listening to the podcast is like, it like kind of infuriates you, but in a good, like cathartic way. So I'd encourage folks to listen.
I mean, this is, you know, Nicole Hannah Jones' original territory, education policy. And she went on to do the 1619 project for the New York Times. But she also did an episode for This American Life a few years ago on a school redistricting or redrawing the lines for some high schools outside St. Louis. And it was occurring essentially in the wake of Ferguson and geographically proximate to Ferguson. And she has the live audio from the school board hearing. And there's some white people who say some really horrible shit. But it doesn't sound horrible because it's Midwestern nice, but it is questions around property values and these people and all kinds. I mean, it's objectively horrifying to listen to, or at least it should be. So that's a very interesting piece. I have done nothing quite so informative or grand. I am still listening to an audio book, which I still call a book on tape, usually when I talk about it.
Me too.
called Billion Dollar Whale. Which I started listening to as I was driving to and from Colorado. But it's about the one MDB scandal and Joe Lowe, the kind of Malaysian financier slash scam artist who's involved with it. But that group also financed Wolf of Wall Street. And so on the one hand, this is a whole sort of dissection of the corruption of sovereign wealth funds and how money laundering. But it's also related to a whole bunch of celebrities. So there's like crazy celebrities that show up. Alicia Keys and Leonardo DiCaprio and Kimora Simmons.
I love a good, it's a little bit like, what's her name? The crazy Silicon Valley healthcare lady.
Yes.
I love a good like investment corruption story that involves
some celebrities. Yeah. So yeah. This, it's a little over long. Like I need it to kind of wrap up so I can move on to my next thing. But it's, if you're kind of, I find money laundering fascinating. Like it's just legitimately a weird thing to me. But it's kind of fun. But I've also been watching, as you might imagine, because I don't have small children at home, a lot of Netflix and other things. Friend of the show, Steve Sadman, a professor, got me hooked on Bosch, which is a modern, like, noir detective series set in L.A. It's nothing particularly special. It's just well done. It's not super creepy. I recognize some of the landmarks in L.A., and that's, like, an interesting, like, backflash to the before time, you know, so that's fun. I also am watching Cursed, which is an Arthur adaptation on Netflix. My, like, insomnia is kind of back, and so I watch this between the hours of, like, midnight and 3 a.m., it's perfect at that hour.
I could compliment that insomnia with some children who wake up at that time. So just like, if you want to rock this out, I've got some activities for you.
We got to figure out. I feel
because I don't have insomnia.
I know you don't. and I also watched the new season of The Umbrella Academy. So maybe we'll wait and see when Lauren is back and if she dives into this as well. You know, my standard for quarantine viewing is different. That, like, is the new season of Umbrella Academy good? It is not. Should you watch it? Why not? What else do you have to do? I mean, so, you know, and it's, again, also not super duper stressful.
That's but the key at this point.
That's, you know, it's, I'm interested to see. Cursed is like Arthurian, but it's a very weird take on a bunch of Arthur stuff. And so you basically just have to forget that it's an Arthur story. And it happens to have a guy named Arthur and a guy named Merlin. And then some people who maybe are fairies or maybe not. And move on with it.
I just feel like 3 months ago, Radha, would have been totally fine with that. And now,
you're invested.
I went so deep down this Arthurian legend.
We got to investigate.
Like, what's the deal with all that investment if they're going to just throw it out the window?
I agree. We got to lobby for the next book of the Guinevere Deception.
Right.
I need answers.
Moving into pandemic crisis, guys. Get that supply chain rolling.
All right. Well, I think that's a pretty full episode for us here. We'll see everyone in a couple of weeks. Thanks.